Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. And this is my last show of 2011, which is really amazing how quickly this year has gone by. We have a full show tonight. First, I'll be talking with Mary Beth Brangen about some important subjects, what's new regarding smart meters and full spectrum dominance. Later in the show, I'll be playing my interview with Lema Bowie of Liberia, a recent Nobel Peace Prize recipient. But first, a little of my music, They Are Innocent, coming from the depths of my journey, thinking of all the suffering people in the world who are innocent, just like you and me. And I want to play this song in honor of the unarmed women protesters in Cairo, being chased by police in riot gear, beaten to the ground with metal bars, stripped and kicked, beaten unconscious. Scenes of an officer slapping a detained old woman in the face.
People who are hurting all around you.
Okay. Award-winning filmmakers Mary Beth Brangen and her partner James Heddle co-direct EON, Ecological Options Network, www.eon3.net. They have been very involved with the smart meter issues along with many other pressing issues of the day. Their videos have been broadcast internationally on PBS and Free Speech TV and used by activists worldwide. She and Jim returned recently from a three-day public conference on the great emerging issues of the Asia-Pacific region and their effects on island nations of the Pacific, as well as a conference in D.C. on wireless safety issues. Welcome, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Janie. And I just have to say that was a gorgeous piece you did. That was beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad we have a chance to finish our conversation from last month. So what is the latest with the smart meter saga?
There is a California Public Utilities Commission is where the battle is being fought legally. And today, PG&E just filed a response or a reply to the comments that we all filed last week that contested the plan that Chairman Peavy, the chairman of the board of the commission, had proposed for the opt-out plan for the smart meters. And all of us said it was inadequate, it was a total boondoggle, that it was extortion to charge us for what wouldn't even solve the problem in that plan. So today, PG&E, and in the meantime, what probably brought PG&E to doing this is in Santa Cruz, six women who've been made ill and their children and families have been made ill by the smart meters had a public returning of their smart meters to the PG&E office. They had all hired licensed electricians to take the smart meters off of their homes and to replace them with analog meters. Well, PG&E totally overreacted and was so mean. They cut those women's electricity off completely, which then got reported widely as PG&E was the Grinch that stole Christmas. Can you imagine turning off electricity in this cold weather to all these people because they were being made sick by the smart meters? So then PG&E, in an effort to avoid the horrendously bad image that was projecting after San Bruno and everything else that's going on with PG&E, filed this comment today saying, okay, we will allow an analog meter to be one of the options in the opt-out process. Well, that was very big of them, but they still want to charge such an exorbitant amount, the PG&E rate, what they would like to charge is like $170, $140 to $170 up front, and then $20 extra per month. So we still have some work to do, but this is a gain for those of us who are resisting that absolutely draconian plan of forcing a class 2B carcinogen to be placed on your home.
Really? Really?
In conclusion, everybody out there listening, be sure to call and get the PG&E, get onto the PG&E delay list if you aren't already, because and even if you've already got a smart meter, call them, because if you're on that list, I think you have more of a chance that you will be recognized by PG&E when they make this decision at the CPUC in January. Mm-hmm. I think they want to make it in January, like January 12th. So if they did that, they want to close off any option for getting on the delay list after that.
Past that, yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for that. We are in such a tight time frame here. I really want to know what you want to say about full spectrum dominance.
Well, I'm not sure what the question was from your listener who called in, but I'll just do a quick overview of full spectrum dominance. It was put out in the Joint Vision 2020, which was issued by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 2000, and it's the plan for the defense departments of the U.S. that they will achieve worldwide full-spectrum dominance in space, air, land, sea, and information. That's all they want to do. And they're looking at space as a new market. And the weapons corporations are salivating, and they've been saying for decades that the Star Wars, which was begun under Reagan, as you will recall, will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet. So they are just, they have dollar signs in their eyes, and so they're pushing this forward. The aerospace industry is wanting to establish mining colonies in the moon and Mars and other planets, and they want to use nuclear reactors to power those bases. So the nuclear industry is also seeing space as a new market for more profit. So now NASA is part of the Air Force Space Command under the bomber wing of the Strategic Air Command, and all of NASA's missions are now supposed to be dual-purpose, both military and civilian. Well, as you can imagine, this is really a problem from many, many points of view, and there have already been three really significant accidents with radioactive materials in space. So this is what we're looking at with the full spectrum dominance, and those accidents sent plutonium dispersing all over the planet, and one of them did. That was 2.1 pounds of plutonium was dispersed.
Good heavens.
Yeah, that was in 1964. And then there was one in 1996 that had a half pound of plutonium, and that went over the mountains of Chile and Bolivia. So we're still don't seem to have learned this lesson. And the Star Wars is an aggressive first strike system that they want to employ. And it's making a new nuclear arms race with China because of this. So, I discovered when I was looking into this for this update for you and your program that there is a Russian, a failed Russian space probe that was sent up that is expected to fall to the planet between January 6th and January 19th.
You mean upcoming?
Right, the upcoming January, right around the corner. And it's called the Phobos Grunt Space Probe. Grunt turns out to be the Russian word for soil.
I see.
And Phobos is a moon from Mars. And it didn't get into the outer orbit the way it was supposed to, so it will come crashing down between January 6th and the 19th, and it has 22 pounds of cobalt-57 on board.
Oh, my God.
Now, cobalt-57 isn't as hazardous and nasty as plutonium, but it still can cause cancer, and it has a hazardous life of between 2,700 days and 1,458,000 days. And then I was just in the midst of dividing that by 365 when you called.
I see.
So that this is full spectrum dominance at work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then HAARP. HAARP must play a part in all of this.
Oh, yeah. HAARP is part of their integrated systems, and that's a whole other discussion. But it's definitely, it's using electromagnetic force to bounce signals off the ionosphere,
right,
microwave beams, and to do a variety of different things that are also in concert with the what's called chemtrailing or persistent contrails is another term for them that people see being used in all over the world, and particularly it seems along the California coast.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But what's in those trails? What's being dumped on us?
Well, you know, there's so many things. I recommend people go to Roslyn Peterson's site, which is, my mind's blanking, but Google Roslyn Peterson.
Okay, I'm familiar with her.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I also wanted to just round this up because as well as the military full-spectrum dominance, there's also such a thing as economic full-spectrum dominance, and the Koch brothers are a good example of that. And you can get a copy of a report called Outing the Oligarchy at ifg.org.
ifg.org.
Outing the Oligarchy. These are the people, the multi-billionaires of the world that are profiting from climate change and blocking the solutions. Everybody needs to know their names, their addresses,
yes,
and
yes,
we can then figure out a way to have full spectrum resistance.
Great. Wonderful. I can't thank you enough, Mary Beth. You're wonderful to come on and give us this really, really important information.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that was wonderful. Now time to move on to Lema Bowie, whose story was told in the 2008 documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and who was recently honored with a Nobel Peace Prize. This interview took place 2 days before she received the award. Lema, a young woman and trauma counselor in war-ravaged Liberia in 2002, organized the Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace, saying, "In the past, we were silent, but after being killed, raped, dehumanized, and infected with disease, watching our children and families destroyed, war has taught us that the future lies in saying no to violence and yes to peace. We will not relent until peace prevails." Their movement brought an end to the Second Liberian Civil War in 2003 and led to the election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, the first African nation with a female president. Okay, so I'm going to play the interview straight through. It's 31 minutes. This is KZYX and Z. You're listening to Women's Voices. This is Janie Reasoner. We've been listening to Mary Beth Brangen of Eons, and now we'll be listening to my interview with the recent Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Lema Bowie. Thank you so much. I so appreciate your taking time to do this, Lema.
No problem.
My show is an hour long. I don't expect to keep you for an hour, but as long as you can be on the air, I mean, this is taped, of course, that would be wonderful. Do you have an idea of how long you can do this, or shall we play it by ear?
I probably can do up to 30 minutes.
Okay.
Or less than that, because I have to get ready to go to an event.
Okay, great. That would be perfect. May I ask what event you're doing? Why are you here?
Well, I'm actually on book tour. As part of my tour today, I'm going to the UCSB campus in Santa Barbara, California here. I'll do a talk with some students and guests. And then I will do another talk at 4, and then I will do leave. And tomorrow I will do some community events in LA here, and then I'll do something at the public library. So this is like the West Coast tour.
I guess it is. Good. Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War, right?
Yeah,
wonderful. I haven't, of course, seen your book, but I read a little bit of what I could online on Amazon, and it looks wonderful. The first question I ask my guests, and this is coming out of the blue for you, is because this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother or perhaps your grandmother play in your life to help you, you know, play a part in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, usually what I say to people is that my 101 feminism came from my grandmother. Uh-huh. And then if there's anything called the 202 feminism, that was from my mother. I'm from a family that has a very strong matriarchal lineage. The women in my family are very, very strong. And as a matter of fact, the region of Liberia that I come from, the women in that region are not just they say, but that's what I have seen as I've been growing up. The women are the breadwinners. They are the strong ones in that region, like most of the regions in Liberia. So that's the lineage I come from. But the other thing is that most African families can boast of having brothers who fought for them or who was around for them. We grew up in a family of all girls, 5 girls. Huh. My mother never had a son. So we were taught to do things like any boy in a community would do.
Wow. Well, that's certainly a work to your advantage.
Well, yes.
You know, there's many questions I want to ask, but I saw the movie Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is so, so powerful. And your vision and your strength and daring to carry it out is so, that's why it's so appealing to all of us. And of course, it worked. And many women in this country, we don't see women in this country doing things like that. It just doesn't happen.
Well, I think it does. But in like our movement, would not have gotten the kind of recognition it has gotten if we had not been fortunate for the makers of the documentary to have gone to Liberia at the time, heard the story, and decided this was a story worthy of media's attention. Uh-huh. So it's on that basis that I think that it's something that people are doing every day. The one thing I tell people when they say, oh, how can we do this? The first question I ask is, how are people, if you look around, you have a lot of inner cities here in the U.S., and it's not always a 0% success rate of children in those communities, especially with single mothers. It's not all of them that go to prison. What you see in some of those communities are some children who grow up in those inner cities without any crime record, and they go into the world and become good corporate executives, just like any other person who grew up in a very successful, rich neighborhood. The problem the world has is that those are not the kind of stories that are exotic to the press. What is sexy to the press is the stories of crime, death, and all of the different negative life drama. I think if people were taking up time to showcase successful single mothers who have brought up successful children into the media limelight, you will know that in different communities, they have strong women as one. Two, you have serious problems with drugs in some of these communities. In one community in Philadelphia, I heard when the women, I haven't met them, but there are plans on the way for us to meet. But these women have, after they watched the film Pray the Devil Back to Hell, they've gathered Mother Against Gun Violence or something like that, formed themselves, and they've been working over the last 2 years. And I think as part of their advocacy campaign, they've been able to shut down one or two businesses that sell guns in their communities. These are very good stories, but the problem is, how do we get them to be shown in the limelight, like Pray the Devil Back to Hell? And I don't want to say women are not doing anything in this country. In different communities, in different parts, women are doing things. If you ask me, my other disappointment is when it comes to the America's policy on all of the different things. Granted that you've had problems with terrorism, which is very unfortunate, but I know that war and violence have never solved any problem, and I'm speaking from the perspective of a peace activist and someone who survived war. So I think sometimes I feel a bit disappointed is that a rallying call, a national call from women in America to this administration and to any other incoming administration that will no longer tolerate our sons going to war in other countries in the name of peace, because violence begets violence. There's no way you can slap someone. Someone can slap you and you slap them back and think that after slapping that person is going to bring peace. No. It's just going to inflame and make that fight even bigger, because the next time the person sees you, they're probably coming with a knife. And if they slice you and you slice them back, the next time they'll be coming with a gun. So never has violence solved any problem. So that's my disappointment at the national level, a rallying call for some of the global issues of peace.
You bet. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's really what I was referring to, because, of course, I know there are women. Everyday lives of women are courageous, and they work under intolerable circumstances to support their children. But I think that is it. You know, we see the decimation of the world, of the earth, of air and water and animals and all of us. And the guys at the top, life does not seem to have any meaning. It's clear that women are the answer for this. The return of the sacred feminine, which is what my life is about, must happen. In fact, I believe it is happening. But we all have to play a part in that and make that happen. I was speaking with Starhawk not too long ago on the radio, and I said, what can we do to make the shift? She said, well, we all know what to do in terms of permaculture, what to do to really heal the earth and life and bring it back, but the guys in power we can't seem to find a path to really make that happen. I mean, do we all march in the streets?
I think the problem is, over time, globally, women have come to accept our socialization, the way the world has taught us to believe that politics is not our issue. Politics is a man issue. So we sit on the fringes of politics and look at these men, in most instances, destroy our communities, destroy our world, and we say to ourselves, this is not my issue. This is not what I should be involved with. This is not my business. This is not, and we just go on and on and on and on. if you look at the world population, women make up more than 0.5% of the world's population. How many women ministers and presidents do we see?
Right.
It's because we believe that our role is to give the support to the men and be in the back. But I think until we start socializing the younger generation to believe that the only way we can have a functional world is if the two that God created in this world, men and women, play very important roles in every aspect. So from the home to the community to the national, global, men being involved in the home, women being involved in the community decision-making, men and women being involved on the national stage, men and women being involved on the global stage. Because one side of the brain, if it's functioning, is not a functional body. If the two sides of the brains are functioning, that is a functional body. So the reason why we're seeing all of this is because our world is operating literally on one side of its brain. Predominantly, the men are the ones making the national and global decisions. It's time for us to step into this space. It's not enough for us to keep complaining that they're not getting us involved. We need to start creating our own spaces. We need to start voting for ourselves. We need to start making our voices loud. And that's the reason why programs like your program is very important, because it's about time. But then also, if you do a survey, how many men listen to your program? As a matter of fact, how many women will be listening to your program? If you do a survey of the Colbert Report or Jon Stewart Tonight Show, mm-hmm. you'll see also that a lot of women sit and listen to those programs also. Not that it's bad, but yes, as you engage in some of these things, how are you also charting out a course for yourself? So I think the answer to the world is not everyone getting into the streets, but everyone playing a role from the home to the local to the national, in politics, in everything. Gone are the days where we just vote for men. Now is the time for us to put ourselves into the space and get voted for.
A woman. Yes, yes. Finding that path is not easy. But knowing that you have a right to do it and an obligation to do it is quite something to awaken to that as a woman is very, very important. This is the moment, you know, this really is the moment, especially, I believe, for elder women, for mothers, to claim the world for their own and for their children.
Well, this definitely is the time for all of us to step up and say to ourselves, you know, it's time for me to be involved. It's time for me to leave a legacy. It's time for my children to know that I wasn't just sitting and doing nothing. I was actively involved in dealing with some of the issues that was affecting community. So I think it's about time. There's no way that any one woman can make any excuse, because one excuse would be, oh, you know, by my faith tradition, I'm not supposed to get involved. Are you a Christian? Go back to the Bible. You see women who were involved. Oh, by this, I'm not supposed to get involved. Go back, if it's Islam, go back to the Quran. You'll find women who were involved. So there's no excuse now that anyone can make to say that I'm not supposed to get involved. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was in the movie, Pray the Devil, Back to Hell. You saw what was happening. I'm not clear on all the sequences in your life, but I believe you were already trained as a trauma counselor. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you had children, and there was domestic violence. Is this true?
Well, in my own life, I had gone through a time of domestic violence. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you had this dream.
Oh yes, but the sequence of it was that I left that violent relationship, moved back to Liberia, and stayed in the house with my family, and was able to, at some point, start doing some work. And yes, I had this real strange dream. And it was like someone saying, you need to bring the women together to pray for peace. I felt like, there's something definitely wrong with this dream. I am not the real candidate to be carrying this message of peace, because at that time, I had all of the wrong reasons or all the right reasons for not getting involved. I wasn't married. I was in a relationship that I wasn't married to the person, and blah, blah, blah. All of the things that our socialization teaches us, that, like I was speaking about earlier, that keeps us out of any well-meaning political space, was those issues that I was dwelling on. But I had a boss who said to me, the dream bearer is the dream carrier. So you have to. And we held hands that morning and prayed, and that was the beginning of my personal journey into something I had no idea about, called peace activism.
Wow. Well, it certainly caught on.
It did. It really did. Until today, it's still something that is really, really still doing great, not just for Liberians, but for women in other parts of Africa who have gone through or are going through conflict. They see that as an inspiration and a reason for them to get up and take stands for their communities.
Yes, yes. And the fact that you were able to keep the gathering at the palace, to keep the men there until they agreed to peace with Charles Taylor inside, was the most extraordinary event. They could have killed you, couldn't they?
Well, we met with Taylor, and then we left and went to Ghana for the peace talks. And then it was in Ghana that we had the confrontation with the men in the hall. And the men in the hall were, some of them were comrades of Taylor, but he as an individual was not in the hall at the time we seized the hall.
I see.
Whether I could have been killed, that during those days of protest, I never really dwelled on it. Because the thing is, our life and our lives as women and children, our children's lives have been degenerated to a place where we really didn't know tomorrow wasn't certain. Yes, okay, tomorrow is not certain for anyone, but ours was blatantly staring us in the face every day in the form of overdrug child soldiers. Mm. And it was like, you're not guaranteed a next minute, you know? Every morning you woke up, you told God, thank you. You're going to bed, you went to bed with a heavy heart. You woke up with a heavy heart. That was no life to live. So it was almost like a living dead group of people. You could not plan for tomorrow. You could not plan for future. You could not plan for 6 months later. So even if your roof was leaking, you would just leave it and the water would run on you and your family every night, because nothing was certain. That was not life. So it never once crossed our minds as we did our protest that, oh, we could be killed or we could be beaten or we could be in prison. Because there's something about oppression that when you've gone through it for so long and when that thing snaps, you have no care about any kind of physical condition. So sometimes I'm sure people tend to wonder, this activist, someone like Mandela, 27 years in prison, what was going through his mind? Yeah. Nothing but freedom. And I do not want to even try to compare what we did with what Mandela did for South Africa. But I think if you think of a group of people who are going through oppression, suppression, and pain, you realize that I've gone through it. When that thing snaps, you are prepared to go for how many whatever years in torture, in suffering, in protest, as long as you are looking at an end of that suffering at some point in time. So, for example, you can find people doing hunger strike, and you have a whole generation of people, once you've started something like that, looking up to you and saying, our hope, our future lies in whatever this person or this group of individuals are doing. Yeah. So for us as women of Liberia, at that point in time, people were looking at us, calling us and saying to us, please don't stop. You give us hope every day that there is a tomorrow.
You bet. Absolutely. It's so beautiful. It just does something to our hearts. It just wells up that power and the sense of rightness. That sounds so beautiful and so beautifully put and true. I think of Code Pink and all the daring things that they do. And of course, that takes a certain courage, absolutely. I think for us, for you to set that example and to speak of it, sets a vision of another way of courage. And then your book, here we are with your book that you're going around the world with. Okay, may I read just a little, the Kirkus Review? Searing war-torn memories from a visionary African peacekeeper and women's rights activist. Gibouye stands responsible for what began as a tireless vocal demonstration and soon escalated to a standoff on the presidential mansion steps demanding peace. This course of action facilitated the war's end in 2003 and the election of Africa's first female president and ended the author's personal struggles with alcohol, which I wasn't aware of. With commanding charity, Gibouye celebrates Liberia's 8 years of peace and continues teaching young women about the power of activism. A patriotic chronicle reverberant with valor and perseverance. So there you are. You've spent a lot of time in the United States, haven't you? You've done trainings here, and you...
Well, I try to now. I tell myself the best, that the only thing I can do is come for a week and go back, because the pressure for the work that I... The pressure to be around and do my work, and also that's what keeps my feet planted and grounded. My ability to go back into my communities, regardless of which part of Africa it is, and to sit down and have conversations about some of the issues that women and children and girls are going through, and then be able to come back and sharing, not just with policymakers in this country, but also with community people, and giving them the courage to, or just kind of like helping to reignite some of their courage to get up and to rise up and do something for their communities. So I do a lot of back and forth to the U.S.
Mm. You're also the executive director of the Women, Peace, and Security Network, Africa, which is in Ghana.
Yes. So I tell people my official address is in Ghana, but I spend a lot of time in Liberia and other parts during the work that I do. So I can never boast at one point in time of sleeping in my bed in Ghana for 30 days straight. No.
Wow.
It's either 5 or 7 days. Uh-huh. And then it's Liberia, it's somewhere else.
Wow.
But never 30 days at a stretch.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And are you have 6 children?
I do. One of my daughters is adopted. Uh-huh. And I have 5 biological children and 1 adopted. But I tell people I lay claim to 8 children, because I have a brother. My father had a son from another relationship, and I took in when he was 10. He's 23 now. I have my niece. I lost my sister in 2006. So I lay claim to those other 2. So I say 8 kids.
They're growing up at this point in time, I assume.
Oh, yes, they're doing very well. My son, my brother is, as a matter of fact, he was the one I was on the phone with.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Ghana, and he's completing computer college there. My niece is in Ohio, and she's a junior at the Wright State University.
Wow.
My son is at the Eastern Mennonite University here in the U.S. He's studying digital imaging, something. I tell people I'm an African. I don't know a lot about these things, but it has a lot to do with the arts of photography and computer-driven images and all of those things. And then I have a 17-year-old who's here in New York, She has a scholarship from the Catholic school Marymount. She's a graduating senior. Then I have the rest of them. I have a two-year-old who just started daycare on Monday. And I don't have a Facebook page. I don't do Facebook, Twitter, because I'm not IT savvy. So she's all over her siblings' pages, and they share pictures of her going to school every day. And then my other three, the adopted one, and my 13 and 15-year-old, they all live in Ghana with me.
You're a busy woman.
Well, you can say that, but as busy as I am, I try to do what I've been called to do. And I see the work I do as a calling.
Of course. I saw a film clip on a video on the computer in which you were sitting on a board, I believe, and I think this was in 2006, but you were talking about a measure, and I think it was measure like 1357. I don't know what it was, but I know that it was
the UN Security Council Resolution 1325.
Exactly.
On women, peace, and security, and I think that resolution is something that drives a lot of work that women's rights activists do around the world now. The resolution was passed in 2001 by the UN Security Council. So, and that resolution calls for the involvement of women every stages
right.
or in every stage of conflict, mediation, conflict negotiation, conflict transformation in communities coming out of conflict. And most of the time, our frustration as people who do the kind of work that we do is how communities or people who negotiate peace in these different conflicts tend to forget that it's not just the warmongers, those who bring the war, that are able to end the war, but even those who are affected by the wars, and 100% of the time, those affected by the wars are the women and children, specifically the women, are the ones who are able to end the wars. They have some of the answers for ending their conflict in their hands. So a lot of our advocacy now around, because if you look at mediation efforts for global conflicts around the world, you rarely find women as mediators. So we're saying we have smart women, and so we need women to be involved. One of the theories that I know is that once the poor process of negotiating the end of conflict starts and women are left out from that initial phase, that is the beginning of the marginalization of women in everything that has to do with post-conflict reconstruction, post-conflict development, and everything leading to the rebuilding of the nation. And then also just reinforcing the status quo of women's discrimination against women, and you know all of those former culture of violence and not involving women. So we advocate for from the get-go, by the time communities start talking about we need to end this war, that first question of how do we end the war, as you're engaging with the fighters, as you're engaging with the warlords, let the women be involved in the conversation.
Absolutely, and they still aren't. Isn't that true?
Even after the UN, even after the UN kind of like instituted or passed this resolution, the first ever resolution clearly stating women's involvement in peace and security issue, we're still having that struggle to deal, which is really ironical.
Well, I guess it really shows how little the men who are running it care about including women. And in fact, if they can get by without it, they do. You know, I was speaking with someone from Madre regarding Haiti and trying to put that back together, and the violence against women continues, and they don't include women and that was
never there. Never. It's like, you know, everyone will be doing something and say, oh, we have to do this. And once it comes to women's issues, then they have a serious case of amnesia.
Yeah, they do. So that's, how can we, that's the question. How to overcome
that? The question or the thing now is sustain advocacy on the roles the needs, priorities, and concerns of women during and after conflict. That's one. Two, going back to my former point, we need to step up.
Yep.
Because there was a report done by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's now president of Liberia, and Elizabeth Wren, and the report is called Women, War, and Peace. And this report was done as a result of the conflicts in the early, late 90s and in the 90s, the civil wars that were happening in different countries. But there was a distinct quote from those two women. They said, during conflict, the impact of the wars on women is a reflection of the interactions during peacetime. So in conflicts, in countries where you have huge issues of rape and abuse during conflict, go back to those countries and check the history of the interaction of men and women in peacetime, and check if they have statistics on issues of domestic violence. You will find a huge surge in those numbers, because if communities ignore the needs and concerns and priorities of women in peacetime, what do you think they will do when there's chaos?
Absolutely. Absolutely. May we all take that to heart. You know, it's 11:15, and I'm wondering about your time.
Yes, please, ma'am.
Yes. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your very busy life. When I do the show, I'll introduce you and tell all that you are doing, the many awards in your life story. And I hope that your book, Mighty Be Our Powers, comes into everybody's consciousness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And no problem.
And many blessings to you and all your work.
Amen. Thank you.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, isn't she amazing? I felt so blessed and absolutely stunned to hear that she had received the Nobel Peace Prize 2 days after I interviewed her. I felt very blessed. We have a little time, and so I'm going to open up the phone lines. If anyone would like to call in and make a comment on what we've been listening to, that would be just wonderful. In the meantime, just a little comment here while we're waiting, a very kind of grim comment. The acceleration of history is showing no signs of slowing down. The threat of a war with Iran is very real. The economies of the European Union are teetering. Drones are being used within the United States. And the legalization of internet censorship and indefinite military detention is looking likely. Hi, good evening. You're on Women's Voices.
Thank you so much for your show tonight. I would just want to comment on when you were speaking with Mary Beth, the enormity of the subject of full spectrum dominance and how frightening that reality is can not only make anger come up, but hopelessness. And to follow it with the wonderful second guest who, against all imagined hope, pulled off such phenomenal acts was just what I needed to hear to pull me out of that funk, that knowing the reality of what we're faced with on a global scale is just sometimes more than I can handle.
And oh, I understand that. I feel the same way.
I'm going to hang up.
But thank you so much. I appreciate your comments. They're very on target.
Thank you.
Good night. Her comment is very to the point. How much bad news can we hear? And yet, Lema was very hopeful. She kind of named it about women, a global women's movement. And that's very exciting. I mean, that seems like is some miracle that might just happen.
The crystal drum sounds, the crystal drum sounds. The sacred war begins, the sacred war begins.